Welcome back to AEC Perspectives. I'm your host, Brian Nickel, Chief Strategy Officer for RSNH. And today I'm thrilled to have Dr. Ryan Shamet, Assistant Professor at the University of North Florida's College of Computing, Engineering, and Construction with us. Dr. Shamet joined UNF School of Engineering faculty in August of 2020 while studying at the University of Central Florida, where he obtained 3 degrees, a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD. Dr. Shamet developed a passion for geoengineering sciences, geotechnical discipline, with an emphasis on Florida's carbonate karst landscapes. His research areas focus on optimizing geotechnical site characterization techniques in karst, subsurface analysis for sinkhole vulnerability, and statistical deviation of geotechnical parameters for regional soil types. Aside from studying the technical aspects of Florida's unique karst terrain, Dr. Shamet also frequently enjoys the natural aspects through kayaking, camping, and free diving while visiting Florida's many freshwater springs. Regarding the workforce, the AEC industry is at an interesting time, Dr. Shamet. You know, demographics show 5 different generations are overlapping in our workforce. And for the past several years, the industry has faced what is commonly referred to as a talent war. Additionally, technology is rapidly advancing. Today, our industry leaders are looking at the application and ramifications of artificial intelligence, for example. We're curious to know what all this looks like for those taking the first steps toward a career as an engineer, the students that you deal with every day. Who best than you to share that insight? And as you've been helping those students navigate not only their coursework, but thinking about that career as an engineer. And you, the professor, are the one we want to talk to today. We're going to go back into the classroom to understand how to better shape the AEC industry's future. It's so great to have you, Dr. Shamet. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Great to be here.
Well, I know you deal with students every single day. And what I want to talk about, just kicking off this podcast, is kind of an overview. And so if you could you give a brief overview of what schooling and experience is required to become an engineer?
Yeah, definitely. So, engineering, people think of engineering, they're going to think of math. So there's no way getting around it, at least all the universities I've been associated with who are ABET accredited. First, you're going to need those core math courses. So those going up to ordinary differential equations. I know here at the University of North Florida, that's kind of that upper math class that you're going to need just to start doing the core work here. But also the physical of physics labs, and then also chemistry course too. So that's going to be like your first kind of foundation or core courses. And then after that, you have to fill about 120 credits of some technical electives and also your core classes. So the first few classes are going to be specific to just general engineering, intro to engineering, your statics, your mechanics and materials courses. And then depending on which branch or discipline of engineering you get into, you'll be getting into some more of the discipline specific tech electives and foundation classes there. So my area is in civil engineering. So, you know, there'll be courses about concrete design, groundwater management, even like a wastewater design class, soils courses, very specific courses like that. And that's just really to get your BS, your Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering. For civil engineers after that, the main goal is to be licensed and become a professional engineer. And so that's kind of where I see you would be officially become a practicing engineer. That's going to require about, 5 years of experience and then passing the PE exam and then applying for licensure specific in whatever state you work in.
So you talked about a little bit about what a student, an engineering student might study, and you have that foundational, the math, the science, and then you begin to move into those more specialty areas. If you're a civil engineer, which would be different than a mechanical engineer or an electrical engineer. So there's different pathways that you can take. Obviously in infrastructure, lots of civil engineering, lots of geotechnical engineering. You can even get specific within an engineering space. Can you talk about, you know, when is that point as you're embarking on this career or pathway to become your student career or pathway to become an engineer? What is that key point? Is it sophomore year where you start making those decisions?
Yeah, I think it's different for everybody. Unfortunately, just most universities, the bandwidth of teaching those different disciplines of civil engineering, as you mentioned, the bandwidth of the faculty and also just the availability of courses, students really don't get a full understanding of what each discipline entails, really, until they take tech electives their junior or senior year. So for me, wanting to go in geotechnical engineering, I actually didn't really even know what geotechnical engineering was until I started an internship at a local private industry in Orlando. And really then understanding and seeing what geotechnical engineering meant made me want to dive into it further. So some students right off the bat, you know, they've had experience and are really interested in structural engineering or transportation. They kind of know and do their studies outside and kind of know what path they're going. But a good majority of students that I interact with are still TBD when it comes to the discipline. And I think that's okay.
Well, you know, I like that view of it. It's a long journey, right? As you become a professional engineer. And so you can have many, I'll use a transportation, many off ramps, you know, and you have the off ramp to geotechnical, or you may have the off ramp to structural, or you may have an off ramp into the drainage or the water resources. We were looking at some of the statistics out there from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, and between 2016 and 2026, there has been and will be a shortfall of 6 million engineers or more. What are schools doing, and in particular, what do you think schools should do to increase interest in engineering?
Yeah, wow. I think just education on what engineering is from the beginning. You know, like my wife always jokes, and she didn't know what engineers did until she met me. And like, to me too, like, similar story. My dad was an electrical engineer. So that's the only way I really knew what engineering was through his work and him having a one-on-one conversation with me. I feel like we're missing that gap of really investing and sharing the STEM disciplines with elementary and middle school students. And, you know, they actually are participating in engineering activities. They just don't know the label of engineering, and they might not understand fully that there's a degree that entails these things, you know, like students tinkering with things, building things, and trial and error, like, you know, the soft science in that sense. So I think, like, the more we can invest in some of these students when they're younger and really just share with them that, hey, this is a career choice. And this is, if you're interested in this, dive into it a little bit deeper in your upper classes in high school. And you know, I think just education and really clarity on that is going to be key moving forward. And I think we're the kind of in the right motion for that, at least from what I've been involved with here at UNF. The schools around here, we have a lot of partnerships with the science teachers and even the engineering academies at some specific schools that are really just sharing with the students ahead of time and exposing them to different engineering career possibilities and the different disciplines ahead of time as well.
And that applies to industry as well. So, you know, industry has a role, schools have a role, and embarking on that education, on that awareness, embarking with young students in elementary, middle, and high school is really the key, because to gain that interest at an early age helps you when you see them coming into school. They build some of the foundational knowledge in math or science. Do you find that when you've had that interaction with students, either through your own school or that you've seen industry participate in, that you're getting a different caliber of student, but also a different interest from mm-hmm. students?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that one of your previous guests used the word demystifying the profession, and I love that. Like, that's, you know, I remember as a student having our little science lab named after a company, and they were the sponsors of that company, and that's awesome and that's important. But there was never a face to that company. You know, there was never like you drive by the billboard on I-95 and you see that. But I think like the more we can connect and show students from the industry perspective and from the academia perspective, that you know, these are people that you're going to be working with, and the people are part of the thing that makes up the industry. Then that kind of demystifies it and brings it more to perspective, and it's a little bit easier for younger students who are interested in the discipline to digest. So. I think that's a crucial thing, and that we have been seeing a lot, and it's been really exciting. So hopefully those numbers do change a little bit.
Well, with that kind of deficit in the millions, it's almost critical that we change it, because our infrastructure is not going to go away. Mm-hmm. In fact, it becomes more complex as technology increases. And are you seeing the dynamic around that as you're thinking about, you know, recruiting students, because you want students to come to your university, mm-hmm. you want them to be at UNF so you can create the next series of engineers that will go into society and make society better. Is that a focal point for you all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Especially, you know, community driven engineers. Like, the benefit of UNF is we have a lot of local students here in the metropolitan Jacksonville, you know, Duval, massive county here in Northeast Florida. So I think that's also how you get a better quality engineer, is that you have somebody invested in the community. You know, they go to school here, they become practicing engineers here, their family is still here. So obviously they don't want to just do the 9 to 5, like get the work done easiest and cheapest as possible. They want to see their community thrive. And I, you know, that's something that UNF is focusing on. I know a lot of other schools in Florida and universities across the, you know, the globe probably focus on as well. So retaining the talent here, you know, it sounds like we're talking about athletics, but retaining the talent here in Jacksonville and really showing them that they can make a difference here in the community by going through a school like UNF.
And in fact, you can not only make a difference in your community, but you can raise a family. Mm-hmm. With an engineering degree, and you can be part of the community, not only as an engineer bringing solutions, but also to raise a family, which is critical for young people coming into the workforce. They want good paying, solid jobs, mm-hmm. and a little bit of diversity around the activities that they can work on. Do you see that in the newer generation coming into school and their desire to help the community? You hit on that a little bit. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the amount of students that come in and just say that, you know, like I'm tired of sitting in traffic on Beach Boulevard. So they want to become engineers and fix it. No, I'm just kidding. But really, like, students who grow up in the area, and they kind of see the behind the scenes, and it starts early on, as we'd mentioned too, like whenever they understand that, oh, like that pond that's next to my house, like when it floods, that's actually a man-made pond, and it has a purpose. And more recently, when it's been flooding, there's an issue with that purpose that it was intended for. So I think like sparking that interest is then kind of it, showing the students, you know, again, like as we said before, the community development of wanting to contribute back to their area, and especially, you know, raising kids in this area, as you said, it's engineering helps with that. And not only are you investing, you know, financially with good paying jobs, but also knowing that you're making a difference for future generations in your area too.
you talked a little bit ago about an internship that sparked you on your geotechnical path. Mm-hmm. You know, as students are embarking on internships and full-time engineering jobs, what are they saying that private sector firms are doing right? What are you, and maybe from your own experience, but you're also dealing with students, you know, in the classroom who are going to internships, and you're hearing back, like, what are the right things that are happening to keep people in engineering?
Yeah, the key, I mean, I think just engineering, you know, academia, in my personal experience, every industry needs to have mentorship. And especially as we come through the area post-COVID, you know, like hands-on devoted time, like really just developing and instructing engineers in how to work professionally and technically, but also just as a community too. So a lot of our students who have internships, that's one thing that I hear that's really positive is, you know, they have one person who is a great teacher and really cares about their development as an engineer, whether it's at their company or not, and somebody that they can just be honest with and have a mentorship, a regular connection with. And another thing too is just diversity too. Like a lot of companies now where you have these large engineering companies that have multidiscipline geotech, land development, structural, they also do trainee programs where they, our students are involved and exposed to all the little disciplines. So, you know, maybe they don't know they want to get into water resources at the moment. So these companies are, you know, for the first month, you're going to be working with a water resource engineer. The next month, you're going to be doing surveying or land development or in the lab, and just having them exposed to all the topics so they can kind of determine which area of interest better suits them.
So are there some things that you're hearing that private sector firms need to pivot on and do a little differently? Or what are you hearing in that regard?
Yeah. I mean, believe it or not, which again, I've only heard a few students mention this, but actually it's like meeting in person again. Like a lot of students are kind of bummed that they show up to an office, a huge office, and there's still a lot of remote work. And, you know, the like 3/4 of the engineers are working remote. And I know that, you know, we're still transitioning out of a time of full remote work. And that's going to look a little different for each person and their own personality and also, you know, their own kind of personal association with risk. But that has been something that I hear, you know, I feel like the engineering office and the conference table where you're looking at design plans together and you're really like working through problem solving together in a team in those morning meetings, like that's crucial for a young engineer and an intern growing. And although you can have the same effect over Zoom, really just the remoteness and the community aspect of that is kind of slow to catch back up, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think this hybrid environment can pose an opportunity, right? And so you're a little more intentional when you're in person and you're mentoring and you're guiding and you're collaborating and communicating. Do you see that hybrid environment as one where you can still thrive in that sort of development process of an engineer's career path?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think as long as there's intentionality in the hybrid, you know, the students know that they're still going to be able to meet with some senior engineers. And there's a time set aside where, you know, everyone will be in office, or there's at least some type of event where everyone will be in office. Because yeah, I agree, like the hybrid system, if done correctly, like that's ideal. You have time like to really work and to really like focus on projects or individual aspects, but then there's still the time where you have the full office sense. And I think, yeah, that's key for that. The full remote, like, although it's beneficial for some and smaller teams who know how each other works and can really encourage each other to still work offline. You know, I think for adding an intern in there, especially students who, you know, their whole high school career almost was virtual, that a lot of students are kind of yearning to get back in one-on-one meetings and to work as a team in person again.
And the experienced engineers or those senior engineers that you described, that's really the key, right? Because they bring that wealth of knowledge, that wealth of experience, the solutions that they've either created or the problems that they solved, and then can translate that to either an intern coming from an engineering school or an entry level engineering grad. So it's kind of in that first, what I call from internship to 5 years, where that mentorship, that handing off is critical. Do you see your students thrive in that sort of environment?
Yeah, I think so. I do have limited exposure in that. But from a few of the students that, you know, I still talk with as they are in their careers now, I think that I see a lot of them and I've heard a lot of them, yeah, thriving in that mentorship, and also kind of thriving in really having a senior engineer to learn the ins and outs of, you know, especially in civil engineering, where sure, the textbooks and the lectures, you know, we teach like the mechanics behind it, you know, but like each thing is going to be different. You know, students who work in Jacksonville, sure, like I kind of guide my courses to be Jacksonville, Florida specific, but if they move over to New Mexico, they're going to have a whole new laws that they have to work with, the soil conditions, atmosphere conditions, loading. They have this stuff called like snow, you know, that we don't have. There's just like these other little intricacies that the textbooks don't teach. The only way to get that information is from a senior or somebody who's actually been working in that field. And I bet, like, you know, those senior engineers or those practicing engineers who have been around for, you know, 15, 20 years, they probably had the same experience. You know, they've worked under a senior engineer and the information is passed down more colloquially, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word, but, you know, that some more internally than it is through reports and documentations and textbooks.
So it's that on the job training, truly. I mean, it's sort of a worn word or worn phrase, if you will, where do you really do on the job training and in engineering, because the problems are so diverse and the challenges are so different from site to site, as you describe, or from climate to climate, or parts of the country to another. That sort of a pathway is something that's going to be really important for us to bring the new engineers as they develop that interest into industry and into academia and into government. We have a need for all of those sectors to have strong engineering skill sets, so that when the collaboration is between the public and private sector, or between academia and the public or private sector, that is a lot closer in terms of collaboration. Do you see that as a place to maybe take that spark of an engineer and drive it to a lifelong career?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I agree with everything. Cause, you know, personally, that's what I love about engineering too, is it's just the diversity of that is so interesting. You know, I always tell my students, if you ever get bored, just move to a different zip code or something and you have whole new problems and you get to kind of start fresh. You know, the principles and the mechanics are all the same, but the application and the implementation is all going to be different. And I think a lot of students recognize that. And the more we can share with, you know, underclassmen and even K-12 students, the more we can share that information and kind of expose that to them, that, you know, it's a very broad discipline, then I think the better we will be in the industry moving forward, getting more interest in and in caring engineers who actually want to see their profession advance in the right way.
And speaking of advancing the profession, I want to talk about technology. You know, we're hearing about all kinds of dynamics around artificial intelligence. You know, industry leaders, myself included, are looking at the application or the ramifications of artificial intelligence. From your viewpoint, how is artificial intelligence and its application showing up in your classes, and where do you see it going in the future?
Artificial intelligence, I know, like in the academia and education world, a lot of people are scared of it, right? And it makes sense. Like it provides a easy vessel for students to produce work that isn't theirs, in some sense. You know, I think engineers are still a little offset from that ramification of like cheating and integrity, because a lot of our work, I mean, personally, my class, they still send in, handwritten assignments, and the calculations and everything is going to be based on their own interpretation. So, with anything, like they could ask, or they could cheat, and they could figure out, work together. And that's kind of like an age old issue. But like, as far as like the ramifications of artificial intelligence in the classroom, there's actually also a lot of benefit too. Like, I mean, artificial intelligence has been around in the civil engineering world, like for a while, when it comes to like machine learning and big database interpretation and model development. And I think there's always been kind of a gap between like these big fancy buzzwords and research and just the typical undergraduate student. So now that, some of the undergrads are messing around with artificial chat GPT or whatever is out there now, where they're like, oh yeah, I can write a birthday card using AI or something.
Right.
It kind of puts it into more like tangible terms, and it makes it a little bit easier for us to be like, hey, well, actually we can use this technology to interpret massive databases and then develop models specific to X, Y, and Z construction application, or something along those
or
lines.
Or a specific problem, right? So yeah, you can identify a problem, have a massive amount of data, and use the intelligence to actually help create a solution, and then back check it and mm-hmm. look at that and say, okay, that computing power, it's just like, to me, I think of computing power is, this is just exponentially more intense. We have, and as we've developed our, as we put, when we put a man on the moon, as they called it back, when we had the first moonshot, if you will, the ability to compute was limited, right? And now it's completely different, and the change in that means you can do some different things. And how do you communicate that with students? How do you focus on that aspect and not on, chat GPT writing a paper? And how do you get students engaged in that so they help solve problems faster, quicker, and better with this kind of technology?
Yeah, I think just showing it to them and not making it some like hush hush thing in the corner because you're afraid to bring it up because they might cheat, but actually showing the possibilities that this type of software and this now accessible, programming can actually produce, and then showing real world examples of it too. The iteration of the analysis from the engineering, especially like examples with the original, like moon landing and everything, the amount of analysis that was performed there of all the what ifs, based off of, I'm not even going to pretend to know all the ins and outs of it, but those what if analysis now, like that engineers probably spent, months or years performing, and now we can do those fairly quickly with just a standard type of computing software or computing power that a lot of our students have, in their hands. So
You can look at the problems differently because you can get a solution or a series of solutions, right? That now allow you to move a little bit faster in the industry, or to give you different options that maybe would have taken months to do and now just take maybe an hour, maybe less. Are your students responding to the technology in a positive way when you present that kind of dynamic where they can actually create more or analyze more? How is that playing out in the classroom?
Yeah, I think time will still tell with that. Personally and anecdotally, I've seen some benefit of that. As you mentioned before, I've been teaching for a small, 3 years now. So grand scheme of things, I can just provide like a little bit of insight. But in those 3 years, even just how we've been adapting more technology here, and and really making that a forefront and focus on the classroom. You know, students now, they use technology for everything. So it would only make sense that they would find more interest in engineering principles if they have technology to supplement that. And I think, you know, that sparks more interest, and we're getting more creative here in academia on how to incorporate that, where you're not relying on technology. You're not just doing black box designing, as some people say, but, you know, you're using it as a tool and as a single analysis technique in your whole toolbox. And yeah, from what I've seen, it really kind of brings some of the mystery of ChatGPT or, you know, AI or machine learning or any of those things, you know, iterative computing, it really brings that into perspective for students, and it's been beneficial for that.
Yeah, that to me is just fascinating, because we're at the very early stages, and even in the last, say, 6 months with ChatGPT and some of the changes that have happened, it just gets more robust and intense. And so you now can think of, maybe even 6 months ago, a problem you could not analyze or solve, or a solution that you need to create being a completely different approach than it was, you know, a year ago when you didn't have that opportunity.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it's hard for me to keep up too. I sometimes just ask my students what's new out there. You know, I need to learn. And you know, going back to your first question, we were talking about, professional engineering licensure. That's why I think the most important part of that whole licensure process is the personal development hours or continuing education hours, where in order to reapply for your license each year, you need to take some type of core-related, discipline-related, education courses or something. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of engineers, practicing engineers, just kind of go take the easy way, you know, simple online class or something. But really investing in that is important, because just relative to history, we're moving in a technological age that's advancing so, so much and so quickly and so rapidly that, you kind of have to invest that time outside of work to learn about the up and coming technology, and, you know, stuff becomes obsolete real quick. And as engineers, especially civil engineers, we're kind of infamous for relying on antiquated technology and techniques. So I think the more we can adapt to technology, the better, again, the industry will be, and the more students who will seem interested. You know, it's not like your grandpa's profession anymore. We're using technology and interesting techniques to solve real engineering and civil related problems.
And the problems many times are even more complex. And so you have to have that kind of computing, that kind of iteration to understand, you know, the dynamics, whether it be the impacts of the changing climate and how that impacts infrastructure, whether it be many of the things that are happening in terms of the facilities that we need to build to handle different types. You know, you may have a semi-autonomous or some of the electronics that are being put into the vehicles, and then you have to match up the roadside so that it's compatible. And that alone is almost, you look at it and you go, how are we going to be able to do it? But with increases in computing power and quantum and nanotechnology and all machine learning, all the things you mentioned, the opportunity seems to me to be one that can be very exciting for someone who's thinking about, I don't want to be my grandfather's engineer. I want to be a technology engineer in the civil field. And so do you see students gravitating toward that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, it's going to take some time. Even though technology is rapidly advancing, just the way we instruct our students and just kind of the core learning outcomes of our courses and the tools that we use here at a university, they're always going to be a little bit slower to adapt to the private sector, the things that they're going to be exposed to. So I think that's a perfect area where we in academia need to be relying on the industry, and just as guest lecturers and site visits, and because industry really is going to bring a lot of the technology, and the students are going to be exposed to them a lot whenever they enter graduate and go into industry as well.
You know, I wanna see if you could put on your prognosticator's hat for a second and tell our audience what you foresee in terms of changes for students and young professionals in the next 5 years.
You know, civil engineering is diverse. You have your other little disciplines of civil engineering that we'd mentioned, but really just, I don't want to say like we're going as a universal engineers, but like civil engineers, I could see foreseeing in the future, like you're going to need to learn how to code. You're going to need to learn how to work with hardware. Like there's so much more technology, especially structural health monitoring and smart sensing and things that like the typical civil engineer who used to just need to know how to mix concrete correctly. Like now there's technology and hardware and software involved. So the more well-rounded, you mentioned, you don't want to be in a silo. And I think that's super, super critical for young engineers to understand. Like talk to your friends who are mechanical engineers, learn from them, you know, electrical engineers, you're like, work with them on projects, because like the engineering disciplines, you know, you decide your sophomore year, you're going to become civil and not mechanical or electrical. But I could see in 10, 5 years, or even a few years, or maybe even right now, like a lot of firms are incorporating both things. And so the more you can like expose yourself to those different disciplines of broader engineering, then I think like that's where we're headed, you know. And I'm pot calling the kettle black here. Like I need to learn those too. Like that's on my to-do list as well. You know, so.
That's true of all professions. And in fact, you know, lifelong learning is, you know, again, mm-hmm. one of those phrases that in particular in the engineering space with the rapid technology change and what your students are bringing from their own technology. You know, if you think back to when you were in school, starting out at the University of Central Florida, it's night and day compared to where the mm-hmm. students are starting out now. And how do you then advise your students? What are the key tenets that you say, think about these things as you're embarking not only on your educational career, but on what you're thinking about as your professional career?
Yeah, I mean, a bunch of different things come to my mind, and they're all super cliche. But you know, it's always asking why. Like that's the biggest thing, and understanding that, you know, between the hours of 12:30 and 2:20 when you're in my class, like that's not the only time you're going to be learning on this. And goodness gracious, like there's so many just extracurricular, if that's the right word, just other opportunities to learn through different mediums, like podcasts, for example. You know, I've heard of a few good podcasts, you know, where you can really get perspectives from other industry people and learn about technology. YouTube videos, there's the, you have to obviously be careful with some YouTube videos, but they do like the verified or the educational approved YouTube videos where you have some people, some engineers who have, you know, stopped becoming full-time engineers just to work on educational videos. To kind of see the bigger picture of some certain theories or principles that we're learning in our classrooms. So I think, you know, like always, like again, not siloing yourself, and I would advise them to always be wondering how that relates to each other. You know, like the automatic driving you had mentioned, that's a perfect example. Like we're going to have to adapt roads. There's all these little intricacies that, because of this one technology, it's going to have a trickle down effect in all of, you know, the public safety sector, the road design sector, the drainage sector, all of these different things. So understanding and start thinking about how those affect each other, I think is going to help. And that's something I advise.
I want to throw a little, I appreciate the conversation because you really dialed into a lot of the technology, a lot of the engineering challenges, a lot of the focal points, whether it be math or whether it be science, whether it be opening yourself from civil to electrical. How important are the softer skills, the sort of interpersonal skills when it comes to engineers? You know, engineers historically are not well-versed in the softer skills. That's a That's a statement. It's not a blanket statement, but how important are those soft skills? And what would you tell our audience, and especially those students that are either coming up in the elementary, middle, high school, but also those that are getting ready to go into their career from your school? What do you talk to them about in terms of soft skills?
Oh yeah. I mean, soft skills are hyper, hyper important. I wish like we would have for the professional engineering exam, the PE exam, I wish there was some way to incorporate soft skills onto that. Again, the cliche adage, you don't need to know everything. You just need to know somebody who does, like, and just building a community of people who have skill sets and you can really connect with them on a professional and on a personal level, like that is so important. And it definitely starts in the classroom, especially in an area here in Jacksonville where like 90% of the students are going to be staying in Jacksonville. So like, you know, I tell them like, we're in school, we're in class for 4 years, but like, you're going to be working with the people around you for the next 30 years, whether it's in your specific company, or you're going to be needing to hire like a subcontractor or something. So like, the more you can develop those relationships and those communication skills and really seeing how you can benefit each other now here in the classroom. And like, you know, again, like another cliche adage, dig the well before you get thirsty, like kind of thing, like develop those relationships, make those connections now, that then it'll just benefit you so, so much more when you actually start working. Because I think the long-term aspect is something that, you know, personally, I kind of forgot about. You know, you're in school, you're taking one semester at a time. When you graduate, you're like, oh yeah, now I'm working for X number of years. And so now what do I do? And so you need to rely on your peers. And, you know, it'll just make engineering more fun too when you get to know the people that you work with.
Let's switch a little bit from this fascinating conversation about all things engineering and how to become an engineer and what's involved and what's on the forefront of the future. And I want to switch into these rapid fire questions. So what is a saying or words that you would consider part of your personal mantra?
So personally for me, a verse from the Bible actually stands out for me, and it's in the book of Colossians. It's whatever you do, whether in work or in play, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. And I think regardless of what you believe in, whether you're religious or not religious, spiritual or not spiritual, I think understanding the, you know, everything that you do, whether, you know, 9 to 5 at work, driving to school, interactions with people in the grocery store, you know, ordering food from Taco Bell, like you're interacting with people and there's somebody else involved with that. So I think, you know, even though that's like kind of my specific mantra, the whole ideology behind doing things intentionally, because you never know who you're interacting with on the other line or who you're interacting with driving next to. I think that's really, really important when it comes to just personally for me. And I think, you know, ideally as a society too, you know, you never know when you're going to interact with people again, and or, you know, what the other person is going through.
Really appreciate that you sharing that personal mantra. You know, we at RSNH take great pride in supporting our employees, our partners, our stakeholders, our clients, and we know how intense this world can be at times. And so one thing we do is we talk about mental health. We've had a webinar on mental health. We think about those issues. And during Mental Health Month, we put a little extra focus on it, but we don't leave it behind. We think about this, and it's not only mental health, it's mental wellness. What is one thing that you do that you could share with our listeners that supports your own mental health wellness?
Yeah, well, you mentioned it in my intro. You know, my wife and I are super thankful to welcome our first newborn son 5 months ago. So naturally, you know, we've been doing a lot of things like skydiving and, you know, chainsaw juggling. No, you know, the, the adventure kind of aspects of mental health have kind of dissipated, but really just, yeah, enjoying time with him, you know, coming home, and he's at that fun stage now where one, he's sleeping, so that's really nice, but two, like, you know, smiling and just like interacting with us. And so yeah, just seeing him incorporate into our like day-to-day life, where the rush of having a newborn is over, and now getting to experience life now as a father, and you know, welcoming and showing our son all the different ways of that we like to experience life by traveling and hanging out with friends and building a community. That's just been something that I've been, you know, looking forward to, and really feels like it recharges my mental wellness.
And that's the key, right? Being in a place where you can sort of leave the classroom there. It'll be there tomorrow, but focus mm-hmm. on your family and focus on your new son at 5 months, and know that you might get a night's sleep tonight when you're in the middle of that after those early months of not sleeping very much. I imagine your students are sort of going, wow, Professor Shamet is back. He's sleeping now.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I don't want to ruin the sound quality, but yeah, I'm knocking on wood every time you say sleeping, you know, hoping that that's continues right. in this progression.
I'll knock on a little for you here as well. At RSNH, we have what's known as a brand essence, and that brand essence is driven to care. This is my third of my rapid fire questions. Mm-hmm. When you hear the phrase driven to care, what do you think of?
Yeah, driven to care. I mean, I think the first thing that stands out is the word driven. And I think, you know, like everyone kind of understands the word care and, you know, like having integrity and being compassionate, but really like what is driving you to do that? And I think each person is going to have their own drive, you know, whether it be, again, like a faith thing or a spiritual thing, or just, you know, wanting to make a difference in your community or the environment. So understanding and really like honing in and seeking of what that drive is personally, and then letting that drive be the catalyst to do everything, you know, caring for people, caring for the environment, caring for your work, caring for your community, caring for your spouse, significant other. I think like that, yeah, the driven thing is the most important thing that stands out to me, you know. And it's also hard as a civil engineer thinking driven piles too. It's just the thing I think of first, but after that, you know.
That's right. And so, well, at RSNH, that driven to care means something to everyone. And when you pull that together with all of our associates, it's a way to have an impact, right? It's a mm-hmm. way to carry forward for our clients, for each other, for the RSNH family. And I appreciate you sharing what that means to you. Now, I've been joined by Dr. Ryan Shamet, assistant professor at the University of North Florida's College of Computing, Engineering, and Construction. How to Become an Engineer. Love this conversation. Really appreciate your insights. And thank you for what you're doing to educate and bring forward that next generation of engineers.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Brian. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of AEC Perspectives. Follow or subscribe to AEC Perspectives wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And remember, at RSNH, we are driven to care.